Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. You're listening to the PMB Programming Committee for December 18th. I'm Catherine Davis. We had some technical delays, and we are in the process of our executive director offering a presentation of his programming philosophy. Thank you, Maxie Jackson. Please continue.
All right. So when we go to the next slide, which is slide five on your deck, it's titled Radio Station Operations. These are the five areas that I think are most critical for any radio station: governance, compliance, community engagement, content development. I break those down, but for the purpose of this presentation, I'm going to only focus on three of them: compliance, community engagement, and content. They're the ones that most relate to content creation, although and programming philosophy. Clearly, the other two have significance to it as well. If you go to the next slide, you'll see this is a snapshot of an element of the 5x5 model, which is the cultivation system I created when I was the executive director of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. This is a sort of broad spectrum look at the five stages of content, and it starts with targeting your audience, goes to focusing your format, implementing best practices. Stage three is about creating signature programming. The fourth is defining yourself as a cultural and or civic institution. And then the fifth one is multimedia and mobile apps and other digital online, if you will, mobile features of your content. The key thing here with the 5x5, and whether we implement this at Pacifica or not is a question that still lingers. But the whole point of the 5x5 is for stations to take inventory and ask themselves, which of the five categories, which of these five stages are you in currently? And I would argue that probably only one or two of our stations, quite frankly, is far beyond stage two. There are stations that I know don't have a clear understanding of who their target audience is, have not defined the psychographics, and have clearly no focused format. And we'll get to what that means in just a minute here. There's an absence of best practices in program scheduling, in program development, program architecture, program research methodology, you name it. We fail miserably in many of those aspects of content creation. Local signature programming means that you have a program that the station is known for. There are plenty of examples of that. Usually it's a morning show or some kind of public affairs show that is sort of the staple product of the station. Cultural and or civic institution is sort of a byproduct of community engagement. It's this notion that our stations can have either cultural, as if you're a music station, you can have a cultural impact. You can be part of the ecosystem of cultural institutions in a given area geographically, or civic, meaning that you're addressing social, political, cultural issues, and you're considered a significant institution in that sense. And then the fifth one, multimedia and mobile apps, just means that you're applying beyond terrestrial radio other technologies to get your message, your media across. If you go to the next slide, number seven, it breaks it down in even more detail. I'm not going to go over this for the purpose of this meeting, but you certainly should review that if you're interested in a more detailed, nuanced understanding of the first the slide we just passed. If you go to slide eight, that deals with compliance. That's a given. The notion is that you're either compliant or you're not. We obviously are governed by the state of California in much of the work that we do, mainly with respect to governance. FCC, CPB have compliance issues that we have to be in line with in terms of our signal, our broadcast, our digital media. Obviously, for CPB, there's some compliance issues around getting government funding. And then Pacifica has its own bylaws. So all of those are in play with respect to programming, making sure that we're adhering to all of those factors in terms of compliance. Community engagement is one that I think is commonly misunderstood. I think it is the most important aspect of program development, programming philosophy. And what I'm speaking, and this is just an image of the five boroughs of New York City, because this presentation is for WBAI. If I was doing it for a different station, I'd provide a different map. But community engagement starts with defining your niche. It's interesting, I had overheard that one of our stations made the argument that progressive audiences, people that we as Pacifica tend to appeal to, represent a niche. The argument I would make is that I don't know any media nowadays that isn't a niche programmer. ESPN goes after a different niche than CNN. So you go across the spectrum of media, everyone is a niche player now, and it's because of the proliferation of cable and media choices. But anyway, with that process, once you define your niche, and for us it would be progressive, and I defined it in the ecosystem chart earlier, people who are progressive-minded. If you remember, it's cultural, social, political, and philosophical progressives. You would define who are the primary audiences you're trying to appeal within that niche, who's secondary and tertiary. Map those markets, those niche communities, individuals, within your geographical landscape. Map the community, find the influencers, both individuals and organizations who you can partner with, who you can engage with, so that you can make sure that what you're providing really truly speaks to the next issue, which is the ascertainment part of things, the need, determining the needs, wants, and aspirations of the community. That has to be done through focus groups, through surveys. Some of the things that Jim mentions in his resolutions are byproducts of this sort of ascertainment work. And then once you've done the needs, wants, aspirations, ascertainment work, you can then begin to design your public service impact strategy. What's the best way to satisfy these needs, wants, and aspirations with our media service? Is it through podcasting? Is it through our terrestrial signal? Is it through live events? What organizations do we need to partner with to make our message stand out? That kind of thing. So that's what community engagement is. And to me, that's a vital part of content creation. On the next slide, number 10, I mentioned three things here. If you look in the center, that is community media. It's what we represent. It's understanding that a large contributing population of our content will always be programmers from the community, producers, depending on which station you're at. They call them programmers or producers. To the left is what's called the ideate process, all the way from idea to execution. The company, I should say the design school at Stanford, came up with this concept. They're right in Berkeley, right in Palo Alto, and I think Berkeley actually, there's a spot in Berkeley as well. So we have access to it. And when I helped design the takeaway for WNYC, we studied at the institute to be able to develop a national program. On the right side, you see social media strategy and the process that's involved in that. In other words, in all of these, content creation is a sophisticated, orchestrated event. It's not just someone has an idea, comes up and gets a show and is on with a little bit of training. Programming, content creation should be a very nuanced, massaged practice. And content is not happenstance. It should be part of a very sophisticated process and approach. The next slide, number 11. Are just things that I firmly believe in and want to make sure that I articulate as executive director. First and foremost, Pacifica is a member of the public media ecosystem. When I was hired for this job, someone I remember on the interview process said, we're not public media, we're community media, and there's a difference. There is a difference, but to CPB, we're all defined as public media. And if you don't want to be public media, maybe we shouldn't be asking for the dollars that come from CPB. And the bottom line is there is too much value in being a part of that ecosystem to decline it, to deny it. Yes, we operate a bit differently. We don't take corporate support. We program with people from the community in a way that others may not. But that does not mean that we are not part of what I would deem public service, nonprofit media. The next thing that I believe is that Pacifica has operated outside of the research and resource aspects of the public media affinity groups that I mentioned earlier to its own detriment. There are best practices that can be modified and customized to meet Pacifica's ethos and special considerations, and we are faith and belief-based as opposed to knowledge and expertise-based. I can't tell you how many times programmers tell me They know their show's doing well because their friends tell them so. Or I heard from a program director that we've got great programming when their audience numbers are terribly low. All that is faith and belief-based. Knowledge and expertise means that you are a student of the craft. You have research that supports and backs up the work that you're putting in, and you can verify it by giving attribution qualitatively and quantitatively. Lastly, Pacifica has a high ceiling with respect to impact on progressive thought, activism, and influence. I do believe that. It's a high ceiling. We've got a lot of work to get there, but it's doable. The next slide, number 12. What I intended to do here is make it very clear that for programming to work, there are best practices, and it begins with your program schedule grids. Again, this is not a producer or programmer-driven grid. This is a user-driven grid. What we know about radio in particular is it is not appointment media, not generally. It's an exception when people tune into the radio at a specific time on a specific day to listen to a show. It is habitual. It's what our routine necessitates. That's why morning drive and evening drive tend to be the largest listening periods of the day. Strict programming, both horizontal and vertical, is crucial if you're trying to aggregate audience, if you're trying to create public service through building audience and keeping there. Time spent listening is achieved when you have vertical and horizontal strict programming. I can explain that if those on the call don't understand what I mean by that. Another attribute of successful program schedules is that they are predictable. They are reliable. In other words, I know every day at 9 o'clock, this station is going to play this program or a program that fits this theme. I know that every morning I'm going to get news on this station, and in the midday I'm going to get music. But it's predictable and it's reliable. The next thing is that I think successful program schedules benefit from having local content and national content, whether it's syndicated, whether it's national content that you're in partnership with, and I think the network has the capacity to produce it. I'll show you a slide in a minute to that end. That is beneficial. We know that on almost all of the Pacifica stations, if not all of them, it is the show that airs at 8 o'clock Monday through Friday Eastern Standard Time in the mornings that is the largest audience across our network, and that is Democracy Now! It is a national program. It is reliable every day of the week. You know the format. It's why it performs as well as it does. And then finally, you do these things because you're trying to create content flow. Greater flow equals greater listening, greater listener length and duration, and better audience numbers. And that means you generally can generate more revenue by having that. So the next slide is slide 13. One of the things that we're going through right now at WBAI and across the system is the concept of, you know, what can we do to complement Democracy Now! Not everybody has a morning show. I'm working with WBAI to design one. This is an example of a clock for a morning show called Rise Up. This is something I developed years ago. But the bottom line is it would apply today. And you see in here some of the elements. I won't go through it now, but if you look at it, you'll see segments that deal with different social, political, cultural issues on a regular basis. You've got time for audience call-in. You've got social media to be extracted and to be referenced. You've got check-ins with the local programs that are produced for later on in the day. All those elements on a one-hour clock make for a morning show that would feed well into Democracy Now! And provide good, solid local programming and presence. The next slide talks about an evening show, and the program directors and the general managers meet with me every Wednesday. And one of the topics we've talked about is developing an evening drive national program, the Pacifica evening program, if you will. I'm tentatively calling it Pacifica Coast to Coast, and one of the reasons for that is the concept is that every station should be able to, in our five-station network, contribute, produce content for this nightly newscast. And so this is an example of what it would look like at BAI. BAI's top story of the day would be that yellow that you see. The other four stations would have their stories segmented, shorter variations of their program, of their pieces, would be segmented at 5 minutes apiece during that 20-minute blue cycle you see on the left. There's more to this, obviously, and I can explain it if you need to, but just want to give you an idea that, number one, that idea is being floated around. We're looking at how to mechanically make it operationally work. But again, it's one of those things that we know is necessary for the network. And I think a lot of affiliate stations would clamor to it and perhaps even provide content. And there's room for archives to contribute content as well. The next slide, slide 15, speaks to what I think is probably the most doable thing right now. And that is a clock that speaks to all of the public affairs programs that air on all of the Pacifica stations. Because what I'm finding across the board is that none of the stations are using clocks, which is standard operating procedure for their radio shows that their programmers or local producers are creating. Clocks are standard across all media platforms, whether you're television, whether you're radio. Most podcasts use clocks, but certainly non-commercial and commercial radio do, and we should be doing the same. And the reason you do that is because not only does it provide a guidepost for the host to manage the show, make sure that they establish the topic and guests, open up the airways for calls, and then also close the show with the proper crediting and giving out social media information that's necessary, et cetera. But it also gives you opportunity to insert what we call traffic or imaging, do your business, if you will, to promote the next show and things like that. The second to last slide is what I call the contract between the station here at WBAI and the programmers. This is something that BAI does not have. I think some of the other stations have variations on this. But this is something that I implemented when I was running the station in Baltimore, Maryland, with about 40 volunteer programmers. WBAI, in this case, plus the programmers, equals community media. WBAI is a platform for public service media. Programmers reflect the progressive community ecosystem of the New York metropolitan area. Access to WBAI is a privilege and a responsibility, and these are the things that should be required of anybody who gets a show on WBAI. 3 out of 4 quarterly meetings must be attended per year, subject to clock and PD mandates. In other words, they have to use the clock. And if the PD gives instructions in terms of programming changes, clock changes, they are mandated to follow those changes. The quarterly meetings are set up so that you can basically keep the volunteers up to date on things that are happening at the station. You can give them training. You can give them information. You can work with them on special events. All kinds of things can be achieved in these quarterly meetings, but it's an opportunity that is not being taken advantage of to deeply and richly connect with the volunteers who give so much of their own selves for the opportunity to be on your air. Conduct annual special events. Each of these programs to be doing something like that, and it's a way to get greater reach into the communities that are served. Provide community ascertainment. These shows, again, if they are driven out of community engagement, let's say you have a program that focuses on LGBTQI, then they should be able to allow you to get some entry points to do ascertainment work in the LGBTQI community. Once you do that, you have a much clear understanding of the kind of content that would serve that community in a much richer way than just some single person's perspective. Social media engagement needs to be part of the process. Participate weekly in morning show. I mentioned how you can forward promote what's going on in the program that evening on the morning show. And then quarterly fundraising. Right now, you know, BAI probably fundraises a lot more than quarterly, but my point is that the volunteers should be deeply engaged in doing that and knowing how to do it in the most effective way, utilizing best practices. And that kind of training happens either in the quarterly meetings or as part of separate training that is provided. Lastly, WBAI, the station, has to provide professional work environment, radio and digital media resources, timely updates, information, and notice, and formal training where applicable. And that's it. So those are, that's sort of my programming philosophy in a nutshell. There's so much more to it, but I think the key thing to take from it is that I'm a deeply convicted person on the notion of community engagement informing content creation. Content creation should be the development that, that happens as a result of meeting with, ascertaining from the community, and developing programs that match the community's needs, not the wants of programmers. And so it has to be a user-driven approach, not a programmer-driven approach. And that is a radical shift, I think, from what most community media operations operate with, and certainly what I'm noticing at our Pacifica stations. So I'll shut up and take questions.
Okay, so who'd like to be on the staff?
Eric, Catherine.
Eric, okay. And?
Jim.
Anyone else? Okay. Anyone else? Okay, Eric. What is? Go ahead.
Nancy, thank you for joining us again.
Yep.
I'm wondering, I'm hearing the variables and the different components that you spoke about to, I guess, consider a program a success or the components that it should have. I'm wondering if you were willing to consider a program successful merely because it exceeds and does very well during pledge drives.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that's a dangerous slope to judge the quality of programming based on its ability to generate revenue. They may only have a small group of really well-heeled donors, which means that they can generate a lot of revenue, but nobody listens to the program. It could be a situation where they just have real good apparatus in place to generate revenue. They know how to pitch better than perhaps others. I think the real measure of whether a program is successful is quantitative. How many people are listening? Number two, does the program offer a service to the community that is consistent with the public service mission of the station? And so to me, there's a lot more variables that need to be taken into consideration other than how well it fundraises, although clearly that's useful and helpful, but it's a dangerous slope if that's the primary purpose, I mean, the primary reason you judge something to be useful or good.
If I can follow up quickly, if we determine a particular program does have a huge listenership, but it's not generating nearly the revenue that it could or should, what's your reaction in that case?
Yeah, well, it could be a number of things. They could be ineffective fundraisers. They might be appealing to an audience within your community that you want to serve, that you should be serving, that just doesn't have a lot of financial resources or maybe isn't accustomed to pledging or supporting a station monetarily. So, again, you have to go back to the question of, are we providing a public service that is useful here? I mentioned program flow. A lot of times what happens, programs are slotted in spaces where it is very difficult for them to succeed because there's nothing around their show that is remotely like it. And so it's sort of on an island. And one of the things that usually helps with pledge drives is not only the way you design your pledge and your drives in terms of the messaging and the way that you cut in on programming, but also the flow of your programming so that people who are accustomed to listening to the show before and after find that show to be appealing as well. So it usually is not a situation where you can isolate a single show and say this show does well, whereas the one maybe later on in the week does better because it pledges better or has a bigger audience. There's so many variables that have to be taken into consideration. I think the big issue we've got to resolve first and foremost is making sure that we're scheduling things properly and that we've got the right programming on, and then work on best practices to generate the revenue.
Thank you.
Kim?
Yeah, thank you, Maxie, for joining us again.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there are many things that come out of listening to this. First of all, the issue of integrating strip and horizontal programming. I go back to at least several decades ago when the old Pacifica National Board discovered the wonderful characteristics of strip programming and then developed the national programming strategy, which then caused the revolt that occurred in the 90s. And the only show at that time that got money, because I was in the meetings when it got the money, was when Democracy Now! And Julian Malveaux were being formed. They were given a $600,000 allotment. So the issue of resources comes up as one question. And secondly, just in New York, when you look at the tri-state area, that's when I think of how we reach out. That's just not the boroughs, but we have in the past gotten at least 10 to 15% of our subscribers out in New Jersey, and we have people in the Hudson Valley in Connecticut. So there's all these, and you work at NYC, I don't have to tell you how they emphasize New Jersey as part of their strategy. So anyway, there's lots of things to talk about, but I just threw those two things out first.
No, that's good. Yeah, I'll answer in reverse order. WNYC really didn't focus on Jersey until recently. They acquired a Jersey signal, but for a long time, it was second nature. But I get your point. The bottom line is you're right. The signal stretches far beyond the boroughs, and we certainly should be paying attention to all of the communities that fit in our footprint, and especially when we have data that suggests not only are they listening, but that they support the station as well. In terms of the issue of the national programming, I think if we develop more sophisticated revenue generation diversification and strategy, there probably would be less of a revolt about the resources being allocated to strip programming. That will always be there, but I think what I'm trying to impress upon people, I gave a speech one time when I was at NFCB where I said there's a difference between contributing to an ecosystem and an ecosystem. And any programmer who's only concerned with their program, their on-air presence, and you hear this all the time. How many times have you heard a pledge drive and the person saying, support my show? I need you to call now and support me doing my show at this time. It happens all the time. I've listened to all the stations during their pledge drives. Every station has this problem. And that kind of programmer or producer is the wrong one to have on your air. The messaging that should be happening should be talking about messages that are universal across the schedule, why the station should be supported, and how your that program is one element of many. It's part of a larger ecosystem. And so I think a lot of that issue about revolting and people being mad about, you know, the energy being placed on strip programming is misplaced when you put the calculation into what is the best practices, but more importantly, what is the public service? And so if you were to go to that slide where I talked about the strip program, slide number 12, one of the things I talk about is that really from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., you really should have stripped programming. It shouldn't be this patch quilt stuff where you've got a show that only airs weekly or monthly. That stuff should be reserved for after 6 p.m. The reason for that is that the most listenership available to any station is during 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. So if you're going to maximize the opportunity for your station to generate audience, to forward promote the one weekly shows, the weekly and monthly shows, you're better off doing it by having a reliable and predictable strip of programming during the weekday, during the day parts, that can promote to the weekend, can promote to the evening, than the other way around. Because what happens when you have a patchwork program schedule is, you know, there may be some people who like that reggae show that comes on at 2 o'clock on Wednesdays, but they can't stand the blues show that follows it. And so they're gone. And so every hour you're recreating your listenership. And that is completely back-ass in terms of program development. I mean, I'm sorry, audience development and creating audience for any station. It's just completely outside of best practices. There's no way you're ever going to generate any kind of time spent listening.
And all that calculates into your total cum and your average quarter hour. And the bottom line is just, it has been proven empirically that that is a problematic approach to programming. So the question Pacifica is going to have to ask itself is, do we want to continue catering to the programmer, producer-driven approach? Or do we want to ask ourselves, how do we best serve the community and do a user-driven approach? If you go user-driven, it ain't about the revolts and the egos and the people who are programming and where they think they should be. It's about us doing the research to find out what is wanted, what is needed in the community, and building our programming based on that.
Okay, Catherine, I'm going to put myself on the stack, but before, does anyone else? Grace?
This is Grace for the stack.
And Ken to the stack.
Okay, Grace and Ken. All right. Anyone else with a stack? Okay, go ahead, Grace.
First of all, the programming committee, this committee adopted to put forward an evaluation process for programs, and it passed the national board in June of 2017, I believe. And I'm going to send it to everybody. It's two resolutions, one including improving listenership into the job description of every program director in Pacifica, and the other is a way to evaluate programming and saying that the program director is responsible for getting that done. So that should be known. And I agree with Jim. Here in Southern California, KPFK has a signal area of about 23 million. And the L.A. area itself, which is, you know, spread out and very diverse, is maybe 8 million. So we don't want to just concentrate on the city, the urban city of L.A., but also because a lot of our listeners and supporters are outside the immediate, what you would say is the city. And also, I think it should be noted that strip programming was put in place in KPFK more in around 2009, 2010.
Straight.
And it did not improve anything. I think it's and Pacifica has survived for 60 years based on Oh, I'm sorry. Okay,
you have about five seconds.
Finish your thought, Grace.
Yeah, go ahead and finish your thought, Grace, and I'll respond.
Okay, so Pacifica survived for 60 years based on really interesting volunteer-created programming, but you have to have really good programming. You can't just let people stay on the air forever. There has to be evaluations so that the cream of the crop. What I'm trying to say is that strip programming that's mediocre is not going to build an audience. Niche programming that is superior and excellent will build an audience. So it's that's all I have. Good strip programming, of course, is great,
yeah,
but it's expensive.
Well, let me just say this. It was successful before cable. It was successful before the branching out of new audio listening devices. It was successful before the proliferation of digital media, podcasts, online streaming. Patch quilt programming is not successful anywhere. It does not work. It has been proven empirically. If you go to the Public Radio Program Director's research on audience development and program scheduling and all that, the data is consistent. You will not find public community radio stations anywhere in the country who are maximizing performance with patch quilt programming. The bottom line is this. That model is outdated, and it needs to be upgraded and updated. That model does not work anymore. It can be done in the evenings. There are less people listening then. People who listen in the evening probably are more likely to be appointment-driven. But if you're trying to aggregate audience during the day parts, strip programming is the way. Now, to answer your question about the expense, yeah, certainly, if you're going to pay someone to be a host Monday through Friday, that's more expensive than having a volunteer who doesn't get paid at all. But if both programs are equal in terms of their execution and performance, I guarantee you the strip programming will provide greater public service and will aggregate larger audience. There's too much data out there. There's too much evidence that demonstrates the impact, the effectiveness of strip programming. It may not have worked at KPFK. I'd like to see the data that supports that. But the bottom line is 9 times out of 10, when you put effective programming schedules together, strips that play, you know, forward and you forward promote properly and you've got good hosts and good programming, you're going to win out over any kind of patch quilt programming. I'll also say this. The fact that the L.A. station only has 130,000 listeners, New York only has 120,000 listeners, that tells you right there how successful patch quilt programming is.
Yeah, but we have strip programming.
No, you
have some. Since the institution, I'm sorry, I'll get on the sack later.
No, I'm just saying, you have some. The question is it the right strip programming? Is it produced properly? Is it promoted well? There may be other factors, but if you had replaced it with patch quilt, your audiences would drop even further.
Ken, Aaron?
I keep forgetting to hit the mute button. Okay. Yeah, hello. I just have a few comments to make, and I'll try to get it in 90 seconds. I first want to say it's a very comprehensive and well-thought-out presentation based on, it appears to be, mostly research and facts, which I very, very much appreciate. And
Thank you.
Totally concur with the concept that focus has to be on the audience, not the programmers. Okay, but I have two or three questions. I have one comment first. We do have a volunteer strip programmer who's nationally recognized named Tom Hartman and on KPFK. And mm-hmm. In that regard, that's one of my considerations, which honestly you may have brought this up, but I don't remember it. We don't necessarily have to produce all of the programming we broadcast. We currently don't. There's lots of shows that we take in on packages. And the survival of the network is critical. Mm-hmm. So if we get a celebrity that we can get a prepackaged at a low or zero cost that will raise our listenership and membership and income, that's very, very important. Second issue is, I don't know if you addressed this or not, but when you talk about communities, I really think we have to move forward out of just ethnic communities and social justice communities. We have to look at college students, civil service employees, people who play computer games, people who go on vacation, people who are trying to get their kids into college, mothers, everything. We can't just stick on ethnic minorities and distressed populations, because that we're ignoring 98% of the market, the potential listeners. And let me just make, there was one other comment. Oh, yeah. Your statement that it's a flaw for people to promote themselves and please send in money because I need the recognition so I can stay on the air. The only argument I'd have against, of course, I concur with you. It's not appropriate. It's not it's not good teammanship. But I believe the success of most strip programming, radio programs, is identification with the programmer. It's Howard whatever, or it's this guy or it's that guy. It's the guy doing the talking, doing the program. You can't even name, I can't name any of the announcers on NPR because they work at not having personalities. They're anonymous, very good narration, and interesting. If I heard their names, I could recognize it, but I don't remember their names. Howard Stern is who I was talking about, or Tom Hartman. So
sure.
Those are personalities, and a lot of radio is satisfaction of association with live people. So you're mm-hmm. driving in the car, you got somebody with you. It's Howard Stern, or it's Amy Goodman, or it's somebody. Yeah. So those are the comments I wanted to make. So I agree with you. It's better teamwork to not push for your own personality. But ego works. Ego works to get audience and support.
All right, so let me unpack a little bit of what you said. And I also am going to go back to something Grace brought up that I forgot to comment on. She mentioned the signal strength and the fact that you reach beyond the urban centers. Nowhere in my presentation did I mean to imply that we should be focused on urban centers. I also don't think that we should be focused on ethnic minorities or distressed communities. I think the bottom line is that what is the through line, if you will, for Pacifica across the country are those who are progressive-minded, period. So the question is, what does progressive-minded mean in New York? What does it mean in D.C.? What does it mean in Houston? What does it mean in L.A.? What does it mean in Berkeley? Defining who the progressives are throughout your listening area is what community mapping is about. So when I talk about community engagement, I'm talking about understanding that we're looking for progressives. And so we look at the five boroughs, we look at Jersey, we look at all those landscapes that we hit in the New York metropolitan area, the L.A. area, et cetera. You're asking yourself, who can I target? That who are the progressive enclaves? Is it ethnic groups? Is it communities geographically? Is it a type of consumer that lives? We can tell by the way people vote. Sometimes you can do census data. You can look at voting data to see where liberal communities enclaves are versus conservatives. Okay? And so when you do that kind of mapping, then you can start to unpack, okay, we know the progressive communities are located here. Now let's find out what are the organizations that are servicing those communities? Who are the individuals who are considered leaders in those communities? Who are the leaders of those organizations? And let's start to talk to them. Let's find out if they can help us get to other people who can help us understand the mindset of progressives in our region. Once you do that, then you can start asking them, what would you want to hear in radio programming? What would you want to hear as a podcast? Once you find what their needs, wants, and aspirations are, you can then design your programming to match that. And you're cutting across all geographical, ethnic barriers because you're now saying, we have found a common thread across all these communities. So, again, let's say I use the example of LGBTQ communities. If I know that LGBTQ resident people live all across all the different communities that we hit, whether it's the boroughs, the city, Connecticut, Jersey, et cetera, and I do ascertainment, I may find that the black LGBTQ community is very different than the white, but there are some through lines. I may find that different subsets of the LGBTQ have issues. So the question isn't, do I want to create 6 or 7 different LGBTQI shows? Maybe I can create a 2-hour program that's stripped across my schedule that on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, is addressing all of those communities' needs at different times with programming that would be interesting to all of them and perhaps to others. And so you're looking for that common thread. NPR's common thread with its listenership, whether it's geographic, ethnic, or whatever, is people who are curious. That's their common thread, curiosity. For us, it's people who are progressive. Design public service impact strategy based on that. In other words, we're asked, now that we know what they want, who they are, let's define how we're going to service them. Is it just through podcasts? Is it with terrestrial signal? Is it live events? What can we do to get to those younger people? Because maybe they don't listen to the radio. So I'm silly to create a radio show for them. I can do a podcast instead. I can do live events. That's how you service based on a research methodology approach. I hope I answered your question. I feel like I left some of your stuff out.
Thank you. One, just if I could follow up, what about the idea of the attractiveness of an egotistical personality on the radio?
Oh, yeah. So let me address that. So there's sort of two modes of thought on that one. First and foremost, most of the NPR stations make the bulk of their money pledging Morning Edition and All Things Considered. All of those shows are hosted by a cast of people, 3 or 4, maybe 5 different hosts who rotate throughout the week. The shows are not based on any one star, but they have reliable people who you're consistently hearing and you become familiar with. And so they promote the fact that that program delivers a certain type of content. and it is part of public media's overall strategy to educate and inform and to satisfy the curiosity. And it's on this station whose programming is consistent with that ethos. And so Pacifica can do the same thing, whether it's Democracy Now! Or something we create nationally, or Mr. Hartman that you mentioned earlier. The question is, what is the through line? If progressive media is the, if being progressive is the through line, then we've got to create messaging in our pledge drives that each show can articulate that speaks to the progressive nature of our audience and the programming that we put together. Only on our station can you hear progressive voices from all kinds of different slices of life, from different communities, servicing here. And we do it nationally, we do it locally, et cetera. And that's the kind of messaging I'm talking about. Certainly, the ego piece can work for certain persons. But for the most part, it's really about selling messaging that speaks to the total public service that you're offering.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. This is Catherine. I had a couple of questions. As a programmer, I just wanted to point out that due to finances, due to politics, due to lack of permanent staffing at the stations, that the producers have been operating in a somewhat of a chaotic environment,
mm-hmm.
Without resources. So
yep.
I would hope that you would take the whole picture into consideration and not say producers are making the wrong announcements on air. You know, with regard to saying save my show, it's a reality that if, especially the weekly producers, I mean, the ones that come once a week, if they don't make money, they can lose their show, and it's a direct correlation. So maybe they don't understand that they shouldn't say that, but it is a
Right.
correlation.
You're absolutely right. And let me just answer that real quick. That's why I push back on the notion that programs should be judged purely on their ability to raise money. That's a problem, because it does create undue and unrealistic pressure on specific programming. Again, the host might not be a great fundraiser. The audience that is being served may not be accustomed to. Sometimes you have to build audience over time to become giving through a program. I used to program Caribbean programming in Baltimore. Those people never pledged, but you know what they do? They would come to the station and give us cash money in our hands because some of them weren't registered and didn't have official documentation, that kind of thing. So my point to you is that the onus is on the program director to create a schedule that doesn't put that kind of pressure on you as a programmer. I understand that some of our stations obviously have financial issues. Most of them are not nearly where they would want to be. And I know that a lot of what we do is reactionary to financial, political circumstance. What I'm trying to get us to do is recognize that there's a higher ground that we should be operating on. We have to put our egos aside, be selfless in the pursuit of best practices and public service. Being user and community driven is part of that approach. And if we recognize we've got to create schedules that speak to the needs of the community, not the availability of the programmers, or the want to hold a position on the air, that's our first step. I am not anti-programmer or producer. What I am is pro-audience, pro-community, and recognizing that our hosts should be a direct reflection. These volunteer hosts should be a manifestation of the ascertainment work we do. In other words, I should be having volunteer shows that are based on what the audience told me they need, not what the individual told me they can do. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but it's not what I was bringing up. I wasn't taking issue with your position. My consideration is that I understand you're presenting your position, and I accept that, but what I'm saying is the current conditions are very far from that, and I see the onus being put on the producer. The producer can only go so far as there's structure within the environment for them to do it, and that has not been provided over the last 20 years, it puts everyone at a serious disadvantage. There's a serious disadvantage with unfair preemptions.
Yeah.
And I say this because the the producers that are on the grid that are weekly shows are making, I mean, aside from the rebroadcast, are the ones that are actually supporting the stations. The strip programming is not and hasn't
right.
for a long time. And, so and the
let
other,
me, let me, the, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'll address it after you say it.
No,
I want to address that
no,
real
it's
quick.
Fine. Yeah, you can.
What
I
wanted to say is the reason the strip programming doesn't do well for your pledge driving, your pledge support, is either it's the wrong shows and nobody wants to hear it, and you can see that in your numbers. But if the shows have large listenership and you're not making money, it's because you're not pledge well. You don't know how to pledge well. That the station doesn't pledge well. They're not using best practices in membership and individual support. That's what that is. That's not that the show's bad or that it doesn't pledge well or that we can't do syndication. Because most stations in public media make the most money off of the syndicated program. So there's something we're doing wrong if that's the case. That's
I would like to respond to that. The reason that syndicated program works is because it's receiving all kinds of funding, not just listener funds. And the problem, at least with WBAI, is not that the syndicated programs couldn't make money, but they're not very often required to pitch. And so
when
you have a Democracy Now! That's not pitching, maybe 2 minutes, 5 minutes at the end of the show, when you put in strips and those people who have the grace of having a weekly show are not pulling their weight. They're not even required in many instances to pitch. A lot of the syndicated programs and refuse to pitch because they have a divided allegiance. So I think the problems at the physical run a little bit deeper, and all this needs to be considered. And I had one more point.
Okay, so let me answer that before you get to your last point. I am clear that we're not ready. It's why when I saw all of Jim's resolutions, my biggest fear is that we're just not ready for the deadlines, the dates that he's suggesting that we reach, January and March of next year. For 90% of what he's proposing, I just don't see the stations even being remotely ready for it. But secondly, part of my role as executive director is to make sure that the station managers and the program directors don't create the expectation on our local programmers and producers that are unrealistic. You notice that second to last slide is about the pact. It's about our contract between the station and the programmers. It's about creating the environment for them to succeed. It's about training them up and giving them resources. It's about making sure the work environment caters to that. Anytime you have programs that are not pledging because they're being preempted, that doesn't even make sense. That's not how pledge drives should be done in the first place. And pledging shouldn't be the whole hour. So the whole notion, again, that's why I keep saying we're not implementing best practices at any level. And until we do, we're never going to be able to say whether something works well or not because we're not implementing anything in best practice. It's why I said if we're not going to do underwriting, that's fine. I'm at peace with that. But if we're only going to do individual support, then we need to understand the best practices industry-wide of doing that and implement that because we should be, Pacifica should be the number one organization in public service media, nonprofit media, and individual support because that's the only way we make money. And so that's what I'm speaking to, this notion that, I know we're not ideally positioned yet. I know we've got conditions that aren't like they should be, but we've got to aspire to it, number one. We got to recognize what has to happen to get there. And I, as executive director, have to make sure that the program directors and the station managers, and I got to manage up to the board, that they understand that they can't put that kind of pressure on the programmers without giving them the resources to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
This is great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I have one more thing to bring up that concerns me. With strip programming, you know, when you speak about addressing the audience in New York, probably in all these cities.
Yeah.
One of the driving forces behind strip programming is that there's such diverse and broad spectrum communities. So So I
Wait, I'm sorry, say that. Say this, I'm sorry.
I said our communities have a very broad spectrum of needs and concerns. So my concern with the idea of strip programming is not that we wouldn't do strip programming, but I'd be very concerned about how those programs are conceived. So very often in mainstream media, public media, and at WBAI, probably the other stations, that I don't want to see us flip from being concerned about having the actual voices and as guests and as programmers of our community, and to say, we're not going to pay attention to disenfranchised or communities or particular groups, be it Arab, be it Black, be it Italian.
Yeah.
The idea from my perspective is that I'm concerned that we're going to have radio stations that are going to be all monolithic. And from my perspective, the liberal left very often feels that they can speak for everybody. And I don't want to see a radio station in New York where I have 10 shows by white men and maybe two white women, and everybody else is crowded into a corner. If we're going to have this national program, then we need to have diverse voices in the construction of those programs.
You are absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more, and I won't even elaborate because everything you said stands on its own. At the end of the day, when you're designing the program architecture, being inclusive, having disparate voices is part of the design process. There's no value in me being at Pacifica if we're going to be an emulation of what I left in public radio. One of the main reasons I was ready to leave public media is I got tired of fighting with white liberals on their inability to create the kind of diversity in thought and in programming and in hosting and in management that I thought was a prerequisite of the industry being relevant for the emerging demographics of the country. Pacifica, I think, is already in some respect there, but you're right. With respect to national programming, and whether it's Pacifica national programming or something we acquire, we have to be asking the question, can we make sure that diversity and inclusion is fully represented and that the shows themselves, as they are designed, are pulling from experts, pulling from community, pulling from resources that reflect a diversity that America has and that the region of the country that station broadcasts from reflects. And so that's part of the DNA of anything we should be creating.
Okay, thank you. Grace.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Do we have, I don't know how full the agenda is. We have roughly 20 minutes left unless as we close in, you want to extend for, say 15 minutes.
Okay, so.
Half hour. Because we have a lot of things we haven't covered. And I'd like to.
Are there any objections? Or is there a second?
Seconded, so.
Any objections? Okay, hearing none.
Can I just make one short comment?
Yeah, Grace, you're next. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're next on the
stack. Jim to the stack, please. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, Grace.
Right. I just wanted to say that I think it's an excellent report, Maxie, and I'm very, very happy that you're willing to face the fact that we have deficiencies. I think that that's pretty obvious to most of us, but it takes courage to say that publicly and to have put forward a path to improve our operations and our programming. And I agree with you wholeheartedly that we need to service our listeners, not just pat each other on the back internally and have the programming for the programmers, not the listeners. The listeners should be where the focus is. And I just feel that, and I think you agree, that we need excellent programming, whether it's stripped or not stripped. It needs to be excellent.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I want to be real clear. I do think there's a space for the weekly one-hour program. I think there's space for the programmers who are local, who only have the resource, time, and attention to do a weekly program. they are certainly valuable. I used to always consider them our tentacles into the community. The key is in that last slide, that second to last slide, is making sure that we are informing them on how they can be our representation in the community, how they can bring the community back to the station and help us do ascertainment work, how through social media engagement they can extend our terrestrial reach into those and deepen our relationship with those communities in an authentic way. Community engagement is vital because the real goal here is to have an authentic relationship. And if we can have that, we become so much more valuable, useful, and so much more of a utility to the listening audience that they become supporters because they appreciate what we're doing in a way that is manifest in its financial support, manifest in its audience support. It really is the way that we have to establish ourselves. So thanks for that comment, Grace.
Okay,
yeah, I think we all agree. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you, Maxie. I'm glad we're arguing and talking about these kind of ideas because one thing I've thought about is that if we have a terrestrial operation, which for the purposes of putting us on a sound fiscal basis, because the idea of strip programming I've never really objected to, although Catherine raised some very good points about it, I think going forward, those kind of issues have to be put into the forefront because, as she says, she doesn't want to have a bunch of white dudes basically dominating it, and that I agree with 100%. However, I also want it to be excellent, path-breaking, and on the edge. And I don't want to see a pandering to some of the BS that you'll get. I know you'll get it on Thursday, because when you put out the idea that you are reaching to a community, well, people will say, we're already reaching to the community. We're already reaching to the communities. That has been an ethos at BAI for decades.
Yeah.
People have this construction that they think because they are speaking on a particular topic that is of interest to what they visualize, and they tend to look at it from a vanguard political perspective, that they are speaking for the community, for the masses, for the oppressed. That will be the kind of pushback you get not only here in New York, but other stations. And I think that has to really be put in perspective, because if people only have a couple hundred people listening to them, I don't want to listen to their baloney that they're speaking for the community. What community are they talking about? 200 people? 300 people? And secondly, the issue of money does come into play. I calculated a long time ago when Amy was given the $600,000 along with Julian Malvo to go develop Democracy Now! And have Larry Bensky involved, that's equivalent to a couple million bucks today. And